Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio. In this episode, hosts Josh and Chuck dive into the fascinating world of Chinese cuisine, exploring its origins and how it has evolved in the United States. With plenty of humor and insight, they set the stage for a broad overview of a topic that could easily fill multiple episodes. Get ready to learn about the delicious complexities of Chinese food. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, potsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and it's just us, but that's okay because we can keep all the Chinese food to ourselves. We don't have to share with Jerry, and this is Stuff You Should Know.
That's right. A lot of caveats on this. Can I list off a few?
Sure.
All right. First of all, this is going to be a very broad overview of a cuisine that we could probably do like a 10-part at least episode series on.
I would say 11.
Yeah, maybe 11. So just, you know, have your expectations set going into this one. When you talk about Chinese food, there's a lot there. We are going to do our best to pronounce things correctly. I looked up a lot of stuff and I'm doing my best, but some of this stuff is hard for my dumb American mouth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is going to be, I mean, it's mainly about sort of, you know, Chinese food, although we're going to talk about origins and stuff like that, origin stories. It's mainly like what Chinese food has become here in the States, although we'll talk a little bit about other countries later. But it's through our lens.
Yeah, there you go. That was great. Caveat City right there.
Caveat City. David Bowie. Great song.
So you said something that we were going to largely focus on American Chinese cuisine. And Laura helped us with this, and she makes a really good point that Chinese food is not just one thing.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's not just one thing, or one of the reasons why, is because it's been exported all over the globe. Anywhere that Chinese people traveled, usually for work to immigrate, they brought their food with them and introduced it to wherever they were. And then over time, the local flavors and tastes and ingredients from that place melded with the Chinese food, and a new type of Chinese food was born. And America is no exception to that. So we have American Chinese food.
Yeah. And do you know what I love about that? This whole story is like everywhere Chinese people went, they're like, get a load of this.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it took.
Yeah. Big time. I have no examples of places where Chinese immigrants have brought their food and people are like, nah, no thanks.
Right. The only one I could find was Belize.
Oh, I know you're kidding. I'm not going to fall for it. And the reason why is because, I mean, I can live on many, many, many cuisines from Asia. I love Japanese food. I love Thai. I love Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. I love Filipino. Sure. Yeah. I like Korean food. I love it all. But at the end of the day, good old-fashioned, like, Chinese takeout is just one of my favorite all-time things since I was a kid.
Very nice. Yeah, that's what I grew up on, too. It wasn't until I was an adult that I was like, there's other kinds of Asian food out there?
Yeah, because that's kind of what you, and if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, that was sort of the first, you know, probably one of the first, you know, cuisines from another country you ever ate.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, maybe, like, Mexican food wasn't that big back then. That's only become more popular, I think, in the 80s and 90s even.
Even still, as a kid, the Mexican food I was exposed to was Chi-Chi's, for God's sake.
Or Del Taco.
We didn't even have that. That was exotic.
Oh, really?
But I think maybe even before Chinese food, I was exposed to Japanese hibachi because there was this nice restaurant in Toledo called En Japanese.
Yeah.
And we would go to that. And I think I might have had that before Chinese food. But regardless, I love Chinese food too.
As we reflect on our culinary journeys and the diverse flavors that shaped our experiences, let's delve into the fascinating world of restaurant staffing and the surprising statistics behind Chinese cuisine in America.
Go get on this bus. Here's the person's name. Here's their phone number. Go to this restaurant and you can probably get a job there. And that's how they staff their restaurants.
Yeah. And Chuck, you mentioned that at least in 2014, 40,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States.
Yeah.
Which is impressive in and of itself. But if you compare it to McDonald's, which is, you know, the benchmark comparison for us.
Yeah.
There are 13,622 McDonald's in the United States.
Wow.
Versus 40,000 Chinese restaurants.
There's probably, well, there's not, because we know that number too. I was going to say there's probably 14,000 Panda Expresses, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, it's close.
The long and short of it is with how the staffing arrangement works is these cooks are moving around a lot. They'll sometimes work at a place for just a few months and go to a different restaurant, maybe for better pay. Oftentimes outside of city centers, you can get paid more, which sort of surprised me. I guess it makes sense though. But if you're getting Chinese food for years and years from the same place, a lot of times there will be a different cook every few months, and hopefully you won't even notice.
Yeah, a lot of the reason you won't notice is because the immigrants from Fujian, I could not find out why the largest waves of migration lately have been coming from Fujian, but they are. But they are coming and buying Cantonese, formerly Cantonese-owned restaurants from the Cantonese owners who founded them. And they're just keeping the menu the same because, again, this is American Chinese. Neither one's making the cuisine necessarily that you would find in their provinces. In China, they're making the American version. So if you have a set menu, you're probably, any chef's going to be able to cook this stuff, I think.
Yeah. Now we're going to talk a little bit about General So, another classic Chinese dish that I've never had.
Oh, really?
No, I've never had it. I mean, maybe I've had it if someone, I was somewhere and they ordered just a ton of food and I was kind of just dumping all of it on the plate, which is the best way to eat Chinese food.
Yeah.
But that's something I've never ordered myself. I kind of just stick to my main order, and General So's chicken is not it.
It's good. It's a Swedish sour. No, it's not even sour. It's like sweet and savory.
It's kind of spicy too, isn't it?
A little bit, but nothing anybody couldn't handle. I think there's usually sesame seeds on it too. It's good stuff.
Yeah, not like Kung Pao is the real spicy one, right?
Yeah, and we all know who likes his Kung Pao spicy.
There's a funny Judge John Hodgman episode about that too. There's a funny dad, or at least he thought it was funny, and his kids were trying to get him to stop making the same joke over and over. Wherever this guy goes, it could be like a toll booth worker will ask like what kind of ticket he wants, and he'll say, "I'll have the Kung Pao chicken." And he'll just say that to answer any question asked by anyone ever.
Really?
And the kids are really annoyed. I think it's hysterical.
Yeah, it is pretty funny, for sure, unless you're in a rush, because then you have to ask the question twice.
Yeah, and I could also see how children of that dad might get really sick of that joke.
Totally. I mean, dads can be pretty embarrassing.
Except for this one.
Yeah, well, not you, of course.
All right, so what are the origins of General So's chicken?
Actually, Chuck, there was a guy named Pen Cheng Wei, K-U-E-I. He was from Hunan, and he was living in Taiwan at the time as part of the nationalist government. He was a chef for the nationalist government who was being visited in Taiwan by the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he created a special dish that was in no way resembles what we think of General So's chicken today. It was a very heavy dish, sour, hot, salty. It was just not American. It wasn't fried. But this dish was named after an actual real Hunanese general from the Qing dynasty. His name was Zuo Zongtang or So Sung Tang. And you get General So from that. I think he was an administrator of Taiwan for a little while. It made sense to Peng. And eventually it got exported to the United States, I think in the 70s, and it just got totally transformed.
Yeah. Apparently, if you're in the Boston area, it's going to be called General Gao, either G-A-U or G-A-O. Did not know that.
I didn't know that either, but that doesn't sound totally foreign to me. Like well, it sounds a little foreign. You know what I mean. I feel like I've heard that before somewhere.
I feel like I have too. So it may exist outside of Boston, or maybe it's, you know, just more New England regional. But Chinese food is very popular as a delivery thing. I can't remember the last time I can. Rarely do I eat in a Chinese restaurant, but I ate in Las Vegas. There's a very popular, very upscale Chinese restaurant in one of the casinos. The kind of place where like a week ahead of time, you tell them you want the duck, that kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And our friend of the show and friend of ours, Adam Pranica, made that with Ben Harrison and our booking agent and friend, Josh Lindgren, and all the our wives.
And speaking of culinary experiences, let's dive into how some of those flavors have evolved over time.
And I think the last time I told that story, you and I thought about like a slice of American cheese just on some stir fry. And then we were like, I think we might want to try that.
Yeah, it sounds like something we would try for sure.
Yeah, very funny childhood memory.
What else? Oh, hey, there's another reason that some Chinese food became Americanized.
Let's hear it.
Ingredients.
That's right. You know, a lot of them were changed to fit our tastes, including the ingredients sometimes. And one example that Laura found, of course, is beef with broccoli. That is not, you know, they don't have that kind of, you know, as far as I know, they don't have that kind of broccoli in China. What they use is Chinese broccoli or gai lan, which if you look that up, it's more like bok choy than what we think of as broccoli.
Yeah. And I was like, where's broccoli from? Turns out the Mediterranean.
Okay.
It was, according to legend, brought to America by Thomas Jefferson, who grew it experimentally in his garden.
And so then he liked to fart?
Yep. He said, this is going to make me blow. And then it took off in popularity in the U.S. in the 1920s. Didn't see why, but it did, believe me.
Well, we got to talk a little bit about fortune cookies, because that is not Chinese either.
Mm-hmm.
That is originally adopted from something called the Japanese cracker, which is a savory thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early 20th century, Chinese restaurants were owned a lot of times by Japanese people. Japanese bakeries were making these cookies. And then after Japanese internment, a lot of Chinese Americans took over these cookie factories. And that got me down the road of like, well, who's writing the fortunes? There's a guy named Donald Lau, who's the CFO of Wonton Food Company, the largest fortune cookie maker in the world. Mm-hmm. And he was the sole writer, or has been for 30 years, of writing these fortune cookies.
I don't remember specifically talking about him or his name, but there's no way we didn't talk about him in our fortune cookie short stuff from 2022.
If we missed him, I can't believe we would miss that guy.
There's no way.
But as a recap, he wrote them for 30 years. He used to write 2 to 3 per day. Now it's 2 or 3 per month because they have just thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he got that job by default because he spoke the best English at the company. And his quote is, I am the most read author in the United States.
I believe it for sure.
It's pretty great.
And then we got to talk about a couple of regional specialties. St. Louis, I remember when we went there. When we get back to touring again, I really want to go to St. Louis. Everyone there was crazy nice.
Yep.
They had really cool, like, regional foods that you couldn't find anywhere else, like good stuff.
Oh,
it was just a good town. I want to go back. But I also want to try the St. Paul sandwich there. It's egg foo young, but a sandwich.
Yeah.
So you've got an omelet with vegetables, a meat or seafood, topped with brown gravy on a sandwich. So you've got mayo, pickle, lettuce, all that stuff. It sounds just totally off the chain, and I really want to try it.
There's another one, and I don't know if you looked up a picture of this thing.
No, I didn't.
But if you go to Fall River, Massachusetts, do you have your phone with you or a computer? Or a means of looking up a photo?
Yeah, sure. Let me do that.
While I'm doing this, you should check this out. It's called a chow mein sandwich. It hails from Fall River, Massachusetts, but it's in surrounding towns there, and who knows, maybe elsewhere in New England. But it is exactly what it sounds like. It's chow mein on a sandwich on like a hamburger bun.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look this thing up, it's not a sandwich. It is, you can't see the bottom bun. It is just chow mein all over a plate. I guess there's a bun underneath, and there's just a hamburger bun sitting on top. Like, it is a full plate of chow mein with just a bun in there somewhere. It's not the kind of thing you would ever pick up and eat as a sandwich.
It looks like Cousin It wearing his hat.
It does, actually. Little derby hamburger bun hat.
Yeah, it's ostentatious to say the least, for sure.
Yeah. Should we take another break?
Yeah, let's.
All right, we'll take another break and we'll finish up with an ode to Panda Express and P.F. Chang's right after this.
Josh and Chuck, stuff you should know.
All right, so we're going to start off talking a little bit about how P.F. Chang's came about, a restaurant that I think I might have been to once. I definitely picked it up a lot as a PA in the film business for like big production meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't speak to its quality. It's supposed to be pretty good, right?
P.F. Chang's?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, especially for compared to
chain.
Typical, I would not call it a high-end chain, no more than you'd call Cheesecake Factory a high-end chain.
Well,
it's virtually on the same level of dining.
Okay.
I'm not taking a shot at it. I'm just saying, like, it's not like the place that you went to in Vegas or
right. Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Peking Duck in Falls Church, Virginia, which is mm-hmm. an amazing spot. It's just like you can go to a mall and it there might be one attached to it if it's a nice mall. Regardless, it is tasty, especially compared to like Chinese takeout. It's definitely several steps up from that.
Okay, I gotcha.
It's just really hard to, like, what high-end restaurant has 300 locations?
No.
Like, when you have 300 locations, you're starting to work in economies of scale. It's really tough to keep, like, any kind of cuisine just top-notch in that sense.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to quickly plug, since you mentioned Cheesecake Factory, our, again, friends of the show and friends in real life, Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison of the Greatest Generation podcast have a side podcast called Factory Seconds, where they're working their way through the menu of the Cheesecake Factory one item at a time.
Those two could not be any greater American treasures.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
I love those guys.
Adam's uncle actually is the voice of the Memphis Grizzlies as the announcer basketball team. And apparently Cheesecake Factory is huge with NBA players. And I was like, why? And his uncle, he was like, because there's one in every city. It's the same menu. It's a huge menu. The portions are huge. And the quality is always the same.
Mm-hmm. Economies of scale.
Well, I was wrong. Apparently they make all their stuff fresh. It's not like bagged food.
Oh,
if you believe that.
Actually, no, I don't.
It's true.
Huh. That is a little surprising, but I mean, it's not like I'm hating on Cheesecake Factory. It's just...
I've never been.
Oh, it's they have a really varied menu that's...
Yeah,
the portions are gigantic and their cheesecakes are pretty great.
All right. Well, I'm going to be a guest on that show at some point. So next time I'm in LA, we're going to go to one and then I'm going to be a guest. And
okay.
I can't wait.
Good.
Anyway, long way around describing P.F. Chang's. There was a woman named Cecilia Chiang with an I in there from San Francisco. And she, in I believe before 1965, before that immigration law, opened a high-end restaurant there called Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no chop suey in my menu and no egg foo young. All this Chinatown stuff is a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
And she owned a Chinese restaurant in Tokyo years ago. And her husband got a diplomatic post there. So that's why she was, you know, doing Chinese food there.
Mm-hmm.
And Mandarin opened in 1961. And that's where all of a sudden people are exposed to like Kung Pao chicken, tea smoked duck, mushu pork, pot stickers, like some of the really good stuff.
And authentic stuff.
Yeah, exactly. She sold her son Philip the restaurant Mandarin in 1989. And he is one of the co-founders of P.F. Chang's.
Yeah, Philip F. Chang, but dropped the I.
Exactly.
So P.F. Chang's, pretty large chain, 300 restaurants. It's definitely nothing to sneeze at. But if you really want to talk economy of scales, let's talk Panda Express.
Yeah.
They have 2,000 more restaurants than P.F. Chang's does. 2,300 in the United States, right?
Yeah. Food court city. But yeah.
Have you had Panda Express?
Yeah, I have. I used to eat it when I was younger. I'm not going to say it's like not any good, but, you know, it's Chinese fast food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not something I would eat now. I would in a pinch. It's not like I'd turn my nose up at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been there before. You?
Yeah, a couple of times. And yeah, it is fast food. And it's great for fast food. It's just it's just different. It's not, you know, Taco Bell or McDonald's or even like Chipotle or something. It's just the Chinese version of fast food.
Yeah.
I like it.
Apparently, it's a family-run business, though, even though it's this huge chain. And in the 70s, they just had a few little sit-down restaurants, and it kind of grew very naturally and organically as this family business, which I never knew, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a fan of orange chicken, you can thank your friends at Panda Express, because they debuted it in 1987, and now you can find it basically everywhere. But they were the ones who came up with it.
Yeah. What's your order in a Chinese restaurant or for takeout?
I'm trying some Hunan tonight because I don't normally eat that, and I want to see what it's like. But typically a garlic chicken of some sort. I like savory brown sauces, umami brown sauces. Usually chicken.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website www.podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.